This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
The economy is doing extremely well. Inflation has come down. The Fed has stopped raising interest rates. And meanwhile, there's a lot of excitement about the impact of technology on the economy.
He gives us his evidence and investment advice on Consuelo Mack WealthTrack.
Funding provided by ClearBridge Investments, First Eagle Investments, Royce Investment Partners, Baird, Bill Miller, Research Affiliates, Strategus Asset Management, Women Investing in Security and Education, and Matthews Asia.
Hello and welcome to this edition of WealthTrack. I'm Consuelo Mack. How is the stock market doing? A recent Barron's headline says it all. It's not just NVIDIA and tech. The market is on fire. Well, that represents a change in perception. One of the major concerns about the current bull market has been the dominance of the so-called Magnificent Seven stocks. Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, which is, of course, Google's parent, Meta, formerly Facebook, Microsoft, NVIDIA, and Tesla make up about a third of the S&P 500's market value and have been perceived to be almost solely responsible for the market's strong performance. This week's guest has been challenging that assumption for months. Ed Yardeni's research has shown that the market strength is not just about a small group of tech stocks, but in fact, many industries have been participating. In what Yardeni calls his S&P 500 Sectors and Industries Performance Derby, he shows how they have done since October 12, 2022, which he dates as the start of the current bull market. Yes, semiconductors have been the top-performing industry, but home builders have beaten the market, as have hotel resorts and cruise lines, construction and engineering, healthcare facilities, and industrial machinery and supplies, and the list goes on. Yardeni has been talking about the possibility of the 2020s turning into a roaring 2020s, reminiscent of the 1920s for over a year now. As regular WealthTrack viewers know, Ed Yardeni is president and chief investment strategist of his macro research and strategy firm, Yardeni Research, which he launched in 2007. He is a PhD economist, longtime Fed watcher and investment strategist, and author of several books, including In Praise of Profits and Fed Watching for Fun and Profit. You can see our in-depth interviews with Ed on each book on WealthTrack.com. I asked Ed about his roaring 2020s thesis. Is it still intact?
I think it is. The economy is doing extremely well. Inflation has come down. The Fed has stopped raising interest rates. And meanwhile, there's a lot of excitement about the impact of technology on the economy. And I think in some ways in the stock market, the roaring 2020s might have actually started on November 30th of 2022, which is when OpenAI first introduced ChatGPT. And the stock market's been roaring ever since.
How much did the fact that the Fed stopped tightening have to do with what's going on in the market?
Well, obviously, that was a very important development because the market during 2022 and 2023 was just obsessed with the fact that inflation seemed to be persistent, not transitory, and that the Fed continued to be extremely hawkish. And then when the Fed started talking more dovishly, in late 2023, we started to see the market really take off, but it actually bottomed in 2022 in October 12th of 2022 because the market looks ahead and the market figured out that, you know what, inflation will come down, the Fed will at some point stop raising interest rates, and the market correctly anticipated that the economy would remain resilient.
Ed, if that wasn't enough, you add the fuel to the fire of the introduction of OpenAI's ChatGPT, and
right.
Then we're off to the races, right?
I think it was important for people to be less concerned about a recession, and a big reason they were concerned is because they were concerned that inflation would remain persistent and that the Fed would have to raise interest rates significantly.
You had another analogy that you were thinking of looking at the bull market, and that was the 1990s.
Correct.
Is this a 1990s type market, or is this a roaring 2020s type market? And what is the difference, and what does it matter?
It does matter, because I think history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And there are similarities with the 1920s. The 1920s started out with miserable times. There was a Spanish flu. Before that, there was World War I. There was a recession in 1920. And yet it turned out to be the roaring 1920s, because back then, all kinds of new technologies improved the standard of living and the economy did extremely well. In the 1990s, we have had a similar situation with regards to technology. And we had a technology boom that certainly fueled the roaring 1990s. And now the 2020s are kind of similar to both of those periods, where once again, technology is leading the way.
What do we have to look forward to if we are indeed in the roaring 2020s?
Well, in the roaring 2020s, the driver is once again technology, and technology solves problems. And the biggest problem we have right now from an economic standpoint is a shortage of labor, particularly skilled labor. And the unemployment rate is extremely low, which is a great thing. The unemployment rate's been below 4% for 25 straight months now, which is extraordinary. And so in response to the tight labor market, companies are doing what they can to boost productivity. That doesn't mean that jobs are going to be lost. It just means that our workers are going to be more productive, which is a very good thing, I think. And productivity is kind of like fairy dust. It's like a magic wand. So many good things happen when productivity is growing faster than average. You get better than average growth in real GDP. Inflation moderates because unit labor costs are determined by what wages are and what productivity is. And unit labor cost inflation's come down. Productivity has actually been picking up for the past three quarters. So we're already getting the benefit. This is no longer just a forecast. It actually describes what's been happening since the second quarter of 2023. So we're already seeing the benefits of this roaring 2020 scenario. And in the stock market, as I said, AI is driving a roaring 2020s kind of scenario.
Are we already seeing the benefits of AI, and where, you know, specifically in all of the industries that you cover?
It's kind of like a gold rush, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of talk that there's gold in them hills. They're them hills. And so right now, the companies that manufactures the picks and shovels and the overhauls are making a fortune. And that's NVIDIA, that's Microsoft, that's a lot of these companies that are perfectly positioned to bring together the hardware and the software necessary to make AI work. AI is kind of like, how can I describe it? It's kind of like autofill on speed. It just anticipates things much more quickly than we've ever been able to do before. And because of that, companies are spending a tremendous amount of money on developing it. I think some of it is going to be a waste of money, but that's the nature of booms and speculative environments. It's a good thing that a lot of money is being spent on this technology, because if it does deliver productivity gains, that'll feed the roaring 2020 scenario, which is good for all of us.
Your research has shown that basically the leadership is phenomenal with this small group of tech stocks, but that the market, the broader market, has participated and is participating as well. Do you see the effect of AI on the rest of the market, or is this just the fact that the economy is good and the fundamentals are good and companies
right,
you know, making money?
I think it's just really early on in the AI phenomenon.
Okay.
I think it will deliver some productivity gains, but it's not the only game in town. There's automation, there's robotics. AI will probably increase the efficiency of these other technologies. So there's a whole host of technologies coming together. And you know, previous technology booms really focused on brawn, on labor strength. Instead of doing things manually, we did things more with machinery, with assembly lines. The current productivity boom, I think, is unique in that it's not just the brawn, but it's also the brain that's getting boosted here by technological innovation. So I think that creates the potential for a productivity boom that is much more widespread than anything we've ever had before. In other words, the technologies that are out there lend themselves to increasing productivity of far more businesses and different kind of industries than ever before. And the good news in terms of the productivity outlook is there's a shortage of labor. That's good news for workers. They are gonna continue to get higher wages, but that's not gonna be inflationary because those wage increases will be justified by productivity gains. So it's a win-win situation.
I'm looking at the performance derby, the S&P 500 sectors and industries list that you have on your website that I mentioned in my introduction to you. And I'm looking from what you described as the market bottom in October 2022. But I mean, home builders, trading companies and distributors and construction and engineering and hotels, resorts and cruise lines. So this is a pretty eclectic list of industries that are doing quite well.
Yeah, and none of them really are necessarily associated at this point with artificial intelligence. The reality is the economy's been resilient. It's done quite well. We've had what I call a series of rolling recessions rather than an economy-wide recession. And now we're seeing some rolling recoveries. But I think the key here is the consumer has really continued to spend, and they're spending on home still. They're spending on cruises. They're spending on getting themselves checked up at the with medical providers, and that all has led to a lot of jobs in those industries, and it's kept the economy moving forward. So the economic environment has been such that the widely anticipated economy-wide recession hasn't happened. Economy has been resilient. Consumers have been spending, and that's been very good for employment. And now we've got a labor shortage, which should be very good for productivity.
Well, let me ask you about that, because if my memory serves me correctly, the consensus at one point when the Fed started raising interest rates was that they raised them so fast and to such a degree that there was bound to be a recession. So that was the consensus for a long time. You did not join that consensus. Then there was a soft landing consensus. And now, I don't know, more and more people are talking about an acceleration in growth.
No landing.
Right, no landing. So right. I mean, how do you explain the resilience and the strength of the economy given what the Fed's done?
Well, there's a few explanations. For starters, the Fed has increased interest rates dramatically by 525 basis points. But where did they start from? They started from zero. So I think it's important to recognize that the real abnormality in our economy wasn't what the Fed just did. The Fed really normalized. They brought interest rates back to where they had been before the great financial crisis. Remember back then, 2007, 2008, everything kind of fell apart. And the Fed decided that we had a lot of deflation risk, so they brought interest rates down to zero, and they kept them there because inflation stubbornly wouldn't go up to their 2% number. I really don't know why they're so obsessed with worrying about deflation. I mean, it was not deflation. It was just low inflation below 2%. But it is what it is. They kept interest rates extremely low, and that was the new abnormal. It was abnormal to have interest rates at zero. It was abnormal to have quantitative easing. And so now the Fed has brought interest rates back to normal, and the economy is proving itself to be just as resilient with these level of interest rates as it was before the great financial crisis during the 1990s and during the early 2000s. In addition, I think what the pessimists miss is the consumer. I think they didn't really appreciate the demography of the consumer. The baby boomers, my friends, are retiring. I'm still working for a living. I enjoy it. Meanwhile, I've got five kids, and every now and then they still need a buck. So I'm still working for a living. But a lot of my friends are retiring. They had two kids. The kids are adults. And my friends suddenly realized that, wait a second, we saved all this money for what purpose? Oh, yeah, to retire, to enjoy life. And so they're traveling. They're going out to restaurants. They're checking in with the healthcare providers to make sure that they can go on their trips. And they're spending a tremendous amount of money in services areas that have in turn created a lot of jobs. So I think that was another big miss of those who were pessimistic. And finally, fiscal stimulus has been extraordinary. I mean, we've never had this kind of fiscal spending that started in 2022, 2023 that led to record highs in infrastructure spending and record highs in spending on onshoring, bringing manufacturing back to the U.S. And look, construction employment is at an all-time record high. We've never had a recession with construction at an all-time record high. It just doesn't make sense. We've never had a recession when payroll employment is at an all-time record high. So the labor market continues to signal that the consumers are in good shape.
And there is some concern among banking circles. I mean, Jamie Dimon, for one, has expressed concern that the savings that consumers accumulated during COVID have basically are being spent down, and you know the debt levels are going up, and loans are dropping off, and whatever. So that soon that the consumer is going to lose its spending power, and the economy is going to be in trouble. How do you respond to that? Those concerns.
Look, it's still a possibility. Jamie Dimon started to talk about this scenario back in May of 2022, at which point he correctly said the economy looks fine, the consumer looks fine, but he attributed a lot of that to the excess savings, which is what it was called largely, that the excess savings that was accumulated during the pandemic, during the lockdowns, people couldn't go out and shop for a couple of months, and then there were three checks that people received from the government. So there's a tremendous amount of cash, and they didn't spend it all, and there was a big pileup of savings by some calculations to the tune of $2 to $3 trillion. Yeah, and Jamie Dimon, I think, was expressing a concern that was widely shared that they would run out of their excess savings surely by 2023, and they'd be forced to retrench. And oh, by the way, meanwhile, consumer credit's at a record high, which will also force them to cut back. Consumer credit, remember, forecasts recessions, but it does forecast how bad they might be, because obviously if people lose their jobs and they have a lot of debt, that means that they have to retrench that much more. I think what that story was missing, for starters, is that a lot of baby boomers are retiring. They have a tremendous amount of excess savings that they accumulated during their entire life for the purpose of retiring, and now they are retiring. And those numbers are huge, much bigger than anything that we have to be concerned about with excess savings. The household sector, according to Fed data, all households collectively have about $155 trillion in household wealth. It's the richest country ever, richest we've ever been, for sure. And certainly what's worth noting is that half of that wealth, $75 trillion of that wealth, according to Fed data, is held by baby boomers who are retiring, just starting to retire, really. There's still a lot that are working, but as they retire, they're going to be spending that money. And by the way, some of that money is earning some pretty good interest. Some of it's earning some very good dividends. Interest income, dividend income are an all-time record high. And meanwhile, there's a lot of working stiffs like me that are still doing okay. There's jobs. The unemployment rate's below 4%. I don't mean to suggest that everything's just ducky and just great for everybody. There are people clearly that aren't doing well. But when you look at the macroeconomic data, overall, the economy is doing remarkably well. The consumer is doing remarkably well.
Is there anything that worries you? I mean, what could derail this recovery? And
well, certainly anything that upsets the consumer would be troublesome. And consumers so far have not been really that upset about interest rates going up, though we have seen, as you mentioned, delinquencies going up in some areas. But delinquencies, again, really don't call recessions. They just anticipate that if something causes a recession, it'll be that much worse because credit's too high, because the delinquencies were already rising. But consumers usually get really upset when the price of gasoline goes up. It's the most widely visible price in our economy. People go fill up their tank, and it makes a difference in people's household income available for spending on other things. So I think if we suddenly started to see a real spike in oil prices, because as we know, we've got the horrible situation in the Middle East, and so far the price of oil hasn't gone up. Notwithstanding that, the supply has been available, even though transportation has been tougher going through the Red Sea. But demand has been weak. China's in a recession, and Europe is in a recession. So oil prices have stayed down. But if things really get much more out of hand in the Middle East, and oil prices are affected by that, then I think that would be a concern about a possible recession.
You know, Ed, you're a noted Fed watcher. You worked for the Fed at one point as an economist. You wrote a book called Fed Watching for Fun and Profit, which you and I have talked about in detail in previous shows. You say that what the Fed does, anticipating what the Fed does, is kind of key to your job as a strategist. So what are you anticipating the Fed's going to do?
At the beginning of the year, the consensus view, and it was reflected in the market, is that the Fed would cut interest rates this year 5 to 7 times.
Right.
I did not join that camp. I think some of that was just some of the pessimists still signaling that they thought that we still had a chance of a recession and that the Fed would be forced to lower interest rates. But I thought I stuck with what the Fed was telling us, that they were thinking 2 to 3, and now I'm not even sure that we're going to get that much. We could have a year where the economy remains resilient enough and inflation comes down and things are working out so well. What's the reason for lowering interest rates exactly? If you look at where the bond yield is today, it's where it was before the great financial crisis. The economy has handled these kind of interest rates before. And by the way, these level of interest rates are great if you're an investor and you don't want to take a lot of risk and you want to park your money in money market funds and treasury bills or deposits. It's a fairer economy. And it's also fair to see capital allocated by the bond market more efficiently than when the Fed was basically rigging the market and pushing interest rates towards zero.
How do we make money in this market?
I think you stay with it. I mean, it's hard for me as a strategist to tell you that if you've completely missed it, that now's the time to jump in with both feet. But I think a lot of longer-term investors certainly have stuck with it. I think that's the key to investing in the stock market is just not getting thrown off the Bronco, because it generally tends to go up, but it takes time. And there's volatility along the way, and there's some concerns. In terms of sectors, I would stick with technology. I would stick with financials. Unfortunately, we still have some issues with some of the smaller banks, but the larger financials, the insurance companies, the investment banks, those stocks have done extremely well and should continue to benefit. We really haven't even had an IPO boom or a M&A boom, which is what typically you get near the tail end of major bull markets. So I think financials still make sense. Industrials have had a big run because of onshoring, because of infrastructure spending, and I think they continue to work. I'd even have some energy here. But why? Because it's cheap. It's been an underperformer, but it's a good hedge against things geopolitically going much worse than they are right now.
So the one investment for a long-term diversified portfolio, what's your recommendation now?
At this point, instead of the S&P 500, I'd go with the S&P 1500. In other words, I think where there's still some considerable upside room is in the small cap and mid cap stocks. I think they've been held back by all this fear of a recession, and I think that fear has dissipated. I think they've been held back by concerns that the Fed would continue to raise rates. I think that's behind us. Maybe they've been held back by recognition that the Fed isn't going to be lowering interest rates anytime soon. But there's plenty of good smaller companies that are perfectly positioned to do very well in this market. That actually, we've seen mid-cap technology companies doing very well. Small and mid-cap industrials have done very well. We could have a melt-up, and then we'll have to worry at that point about, okay, should we take our profits? But right now, it looks like a good, healthy bull market to me.
Ed Yardeni, great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
At the close of every Wealth Track, we try to give you one suggestion to help you build and protect your wealth over the long term. This week's action point is consider locking in higher yields for longer. Here's the rationale. Interest rates are higher than they have been for years. Returns on bonds and other income investments are now much more competitive with stocks. And since inflation is moderated, odds are the Fed will be cutting, not raising rates at some point. There are several income options to consider. One is take the traditional route of buying longer-dated Treasury bonds or corporate bonds. Among the gold-rated bond funds Morningstar has recommended in the past are Dodge & Cox Income Fund and Baird Aggregate Bond Fund. But a couple of WealthTrack guests have come up with some less traditional suggestions. The last time Morningstar's personal finance guru Christine Benz was on, she recommended a relatively new product, defined maturity ETFs, which are portfolios of bonds with a defined maturity date, say December 2025, December 2026, et cetera, that pay monthly income and liquidate at maturity. Ben specifically recommended the iShares iBonds Term TIPS ETFs for their inflation protection. But she told us there are many other types of iShares iBonds Term ETFs available as well. High-yield guru and fixed income specialist Marty Fritzen is a fan of preferred stocks. They are a hybrid between bonds and common stock. Their dividends are usually fixed, higher than on the common stock, and also more secure, yet they can be traded like a stock. They can be bought individually as part of a fund and also in ETF form. A gold-rated Morningstar choice is the iShares Preferred and Income Securities ETF, symbol PFF. Whatever your preference, locking in some higher yields now will provide some attractive income for the future. Next week, Marty Fritzen will join us to discuss not only preferred stocks, but his method for picking top-performing stocks for the year ahead. In this week's extra feature, Ed Yardeni, a veteran movie reviewer, gives us his top pick for the year. Please follow us on Facebook, X, and our YouTube channel. We appreciate your time spent with us. Have a lovely weekend, and make the week ahead a healthy, profitable, and productive one.